Hello and welcome to Muse and Metrics. This is your host, Philippa Burgess. This is season 5, episode 11, and today's topic is proactive listening.
I'm Teresa. I'm a mobile marketer. I'm a growth manager with 10 years of experience working in the digital environment. In this past decade, I've been closely working with different developers, brands in their journey to market their products to help them grow and scale their businesses. So I'm also the founder and marketing director of ASO4Apps. ASO4Apps is a mobile marketing service we are building to provide product marketing solutions for small businesses. I didn't say on purpose that we are a marketing agency because our logic, I would say, differs from agencies as we align our action plan to the developer priorities and budgets. This means we make our marketing service plan flexible so we achieve results even though we have some budget limitations. Very normal on small businesses. The idea is to adapt to the developer and not the other way around. That's why we change this approach on behalf of the client. That's why we don't like to be seen as a marketing agency or a conventional marketing agency. And apart from that, I recently became a woman TechMaker ambassador. I say I recently became because I received this good news like 3 months ago. And if you haven't guessed where does my accent come from, I'm based in Spain. I'm located in Madrid. And although I've been just 3 months in this program, I already got this feeling of being in the right place. I mean, I come from Spain. The woman TechMaker community isn't as big, of course, as in the US. But I've already have this positive connection of this wonderful community. It's like being in a safe environment, and this environment leads to its women to be part of different events, topics, because it allows it as it is a global community. I'm not sure if you have also this feeling to be in the right space, sorry. So this possibility to connect, interact, share experiences with other women with a very similar background, similar challenges in their everyday lives is key because you quickly get this feeling to fit inside this community. And I think it's a great chance also to level up your skills, to get positive connections.
It has been joyful for me. I've been in the program coming up on a year now, and I will say transformative. I feel completely part of a community, and I think it also confirms that identity. I mean, for you and I actually both have that similarity of having this marketing background, and only recently have I gone back to school as a graduate student for tech, and being in a tech community and a tech program really affirms that I'm in the club, because I feel like coming in this creative background, I didn't always feel connected to tech. And I look at my history and I was coding HTML in college because it was just a new thing and I was super interested in it. And I just never thought about the fact that my interest in programming gave me the identity to sort of say, I'm in tech. I've worked in a number of app development projects, and I understand what you say about being developer focused and making sure that the developer is getting what they need. And I think it reminds me of kind of what they call a fractional CFO, a chief financial officer, where you sort of lend your services to many companies that need this position in-house but don't have the budget for it. So you're sort of aligned with them saying, I'm part of your team, as if I was inside your company. Your company just doesn't have the budget and I don't have, it wouldn't make sense for me to just have one client. So I'm going to have a few, but really all of you can think of me as someone who's essentially just such an integrated part of your team.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would always encourage other women in tech to apply for this to this program. In my case, I come from this marketing background, and the business environment is obviously different from the one in the US, the one that you have, also different from other European countries. Of course, every country has its own specifics, but the fact to be able to connect, the possibility to share community with other women around the world, with the Latin community, is like building a bridge for us all. It's like helping kind of include every woman to fit in her own space. And also, it might be because, particularly coming from Spain, which is my case, the possibility to share knowledge, organize events, even with other Spanish-speaking communities, cross borders, cross the seas. It's lovely to connect also with European, African woman, American woman, but this possibility wouldn't be able without this Woman Tech Maker program. And I also want to thank you for this program and also for this interview to make this this statement clear that we want to encourage other women.
Very, very much. I mean, that is part of the show, is to be an inspiration, to share these inspiring stories of how people got started, how they evolved, and that this is a very welcoming community. And it's something that has been an inspiration for me to keep going and to feel so supported in what I do. And I think that that's one of the things about tech, is there's room for everyone. You can come at it from a creative side. You can come at it from a deeply technical side. I see a lot of the work that the mentors within our community, because although we're tasked with being mentors to others, there's so much support for us and our growth and our ability to connect. And what I'm seeing that they want from us is to improve our speaking, to improve our stage presence, to really have that confidence. And it is a blend of the technical skills and the social skills and the interpersonal and the public speaking skills. And I'm currently in the Women Developers Academy, and I signed up for it knowing that it's a step on the path to GDE. And that's one of my goals, is to become a GDE. And it's a public speaking course, which is, for me, done public speaking. I've no problem with public speaking. It's the coding that I'm really working through right now and really wanting to get the technical side of it. So it's interesting to see that even if you're really competent in the coding, there's this whole other public facing side to it. And that's and so I'm kind of feel like I've got strengths in one, but definitely a learning curve in the other. And some people are the other way. They've got strengths in one and being visible and learning how to speak about what they do to help others is their learning curve. So I think that's an interesting part of it. So I want to kind of come back to what inspired you, because you have a very specific niche in marketing and very technical, because you really work hand in hand, almost it seems like in lockstep with developers. So you really understand developers, you really understand their workflow, their process, their timing, their challenges, and helping in app development and in app marketing, which is a very specific niche of marketing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I couldn't agree more with you, because I developed my tech skills over these years. I didn't actually initiate my career in tech. I like to say that I think tech found me and not the other way around, because I have a background in journalism, meaning my official academic background is non-tech related at all. So I wasn't supposed to be here. I wasn't supposed to be trained in the tech environment. I wasn't supposed to deal with software optimization, data analytics, or product marketing. I started working as a journalist. In fact, during my student years, I've got like thousands of different jobs, like translator, waitress, even in logistics. So all this to pay your career. But at the end, you choose a path. You start working on a journalism environment. Then you develop some kind of content writing skills. Then you move on to search engine optimization, app store optimization. And at some point, I end up as a marketing manager, mobile marketing manager with focus on mobile applications, as you mentioned. And although it's not a 100% tech role, it is not about software development, I identify myself more with creativity, entrepreneurship. The fact is that mobile marketing, it is true that in opposition to conventional marketing, is less about sales and business development and more about data and analytics, more related to measurement and less related to branding itself, right? We call, for example, our advertising efforts performance marketing for this reason, because we measure every single metric to evaluate the success of our campaigns, of our efforts.
And that's a big one, is that measurement and that analytics and that reporting. And I guess the question there is, as you're doing this, how much of it informs yourself and your team as far as your marketing, so that you know where to pull the levers, add more budget, change a tactic, go continue doing something that's clearly working? Or is it with your client, or in this case, sort of your partners in this, the software developers, the app developers, more specifically, is it reporting to them to help them sort of understand the scale, the scope of the work, and to sort of say, hey, this is working, but maybe it needs more budget?
So I also want to share my experiences working with marketing agencies in the past, with B2B agencies, and also with developer. Because after all these years working with developers, with brands, you realize that most of the clients aren't barely satisfied with their agencies and their agency results. That's like around half of the agency clients will say they are not satisfied, and this happens in every single B2B agency. So my experience working in this type of agencies showed me the main and common issues of all marketing and B2B agencies. And you need to understand these challenges, and you need to understand how to overcome them, because it's this way how you try to solve all these issues you've mentioned, how you try to tackle them. How is or how do we approach to the client? Let me share what I did in the past and how I'm doing right now. So after university, I decided to move forward, professionally speaking. There was also an economic crisis in Spain, and I decided to work abroad, to travel a bit, to get to know other European countries as well. So I left Spain, mm-hmm. and I moved to Germany and worked for around 4 or 5 years in different German cities. I've been also around like a year in the UK, and even made some gigs in other European countries. And traveling around is also, I get very valuable feedback about all these different mindsets of people. And at the end, you've got this feeling that these challenges are and issues are very similar. You've got same feedback, same needs. So I started to like change the way of working and started to listen to clients proactively to make them feel understood as well. Why I bring in this topic of proactive listening? Because I mean not only to hear about their client challenges, technical stuff, and so on, but to take actions based on this feedback. And I think that's essential. That's when you realize that no matter how good you are on your job, how professional an agency is, or how we are using technology, you always need to validate your input, your strategy with a client. You also need to educate your client, the developer, to understand how we work, what are our processes, how marketing works, and you are supposed to do so because you've been hired for this purpose, right? You are the one that should guide and support the client towards success. And that's key, that this ability to listen proactive to the client. After all these years, you realize that if clients aren't satisfied with agency, what are agencies doing wrong? Why are clients complaining? So there's a very typical also mistake or answer you always get from, especially in Spain, you always get a usual, I would say, answer from any boss from a standard Spanish company, an answer that's always horrified me, which is, I pay you to work, not to think. And you have to understand also this answer in the professional context. Imagine you've got an hypothesis, a new idea, an improvement in a process that you think it could lead to a better result in some way. You come up with this idea to your boss, to your lead, to the board, or your investor. And instead of asking for more details, asking to brief them with a report, understand if it's filled with an acceptable background or of data, they share no time with you with the answer, we pay you to work, not to think. And that's a mistake, right? We come back again with this idea to guide and support the client, to proactive listen and take actions based on this feedback. I also like I like mobile environment, I like working on the app business, but at the end, you also like working with people, right? You need this sense of trust, of being understood at some point also by your co-workers, by the company you're working with. And after so many years working in different environments, in different brands, you need to understand that you need to listen. You need to listen to your colleagues, to the company as well, of course, the client as well. But the fact of particularly working in an agency means listen to the clients, the people who we work for, and you get this feeling that the client isn't always understood. When you start listening to the developer, it seems that the developer wants to communicate that they don't want to get in too detail, blah, 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 or too much technicalities. They simply want to get more users to increase their revenue point. That's it. And if the agency didn't or don't reach the expected results, always the agency comes up with some technicalities, with some blah, blah, that are never well explained. That's when the friction is made. That's a usual case scenario for any B2B business. But then we have, on the other hand, also the marketing agency, the specialist working on this project. They set it up, take actions, optimize it, and report results. But the client isn't satisfied. And the specialist is wondering, why is the developer not satisfied? Why isn't he or she really happy? Because they implement some improvements, they made some support, they increased their revenue. So why is the customer really satisfied? And here's where proactive listening becomes very handful, because the way to solve the situation, my approach, for example, is to have a simple and clear plan. So every action should be included in that plan, in that marketing plan, should be visible and understandable by the client. The client must understand this plan and should have always access to it, to have an overview of the status of the ongoing performance and all type of actions that are running in this plan. The client should always know what we are doing, why we are doing, and what will we be achieving. If not, we are making a mistake. And we need to guide the client to achieve growth. That's how the client should see our plan. That's how we can understand better our services and our activities.
I think that is so valuable to have that very clear, actionable steps and to really make it very clear to the client also what they're paying for. Because I feel like there's sometimes a disconnect between process and results. And they're buying a process, and you have enough experience to know what type of results that could get. But the reality is it's still a process, and that if they're retaining your services, there's different levels that you can be retained at, I'd imagine. And a lot of clients want the premium result for the base investment. And it's trying to communicate with them that I'm flexible with your budget, but also the results are also going to be flexible with that budget too, because if you retain me for more, then there's more that I can do, and there's a bigger team that I can have, and bigger things that I can invest in as far as like technical tools and things that you buy as a marketer. And so is there a community, how do you sort of deal with that gap? There's a meme that basically is out there that has a rubber kitchen glove with plastic rhinestones on it, and then another one that has, you know, pure gold with the real gems. And it sort of says, you know, sort of the kitchen glove is client budget, and the real gold sleeve is client expectations. And so how do you match, you know, client budget versus client expectations?
Yeah, you have to avoid, on the one hand, as we explained, like misleading communication. You have to have, you need a proper plan, right? But on the other hand, that's tricky because, of course, the client will always want more than they pay for. Obviously, otherwise they won't be hiring you. So I think at this point is when tech, when AI is a fundamental piece of this agency. I mean, tech, of course, is always linked to like process automation and including new services lines for any business. But the idea of driving certain forecasts, certain growth KPIs attached to what the client is paying for is also the other important element I also wanted to discuss with you, because I think there's these two big pillars of an agency. One is proactive listening. The other one is forecasting, planning. Why it is important? Because we need like data-driven decisions. That's where the right decisions rely in any business. So you need to understand that database modeling is like the fundamental piece in any business. And it's the element in which most companies fail at. Not only agencies, but also developers. And you won't imagine how many companies, and I'm talking about big brands, big, huge companies of millions of thousands of dollars, don't have a forecasting plan. They don't have like OKRs set up for their business goals, etc. And I'm always impressed how they leave it at like a final point in every meeting, because they don't rely on this type of plans. And I think forecasting is so important, because you need to stop looking behind every time there's a drop on sales, drop on, for example, on users. In the case you have mobile applications, you need to understand they are always asking what happened. And this doesn't make the company move forward and start looking forward, because without a plan, you cannot look forward. I'm not sure if I can I am making myself clear.
You're very clear. I understand. You have to have forward-looking projections, and you have to have the activities aligned with that. And I think that that's where you also, and maybe you can elaborate on the use of AI and the use of other prediction tools that can use past data and sort of start to see and recognize certain cycles, certain times, if there is a season, if you can look at something over the course of a year and say, oh, wow, you know, typically we always do have a lift here and then a drop here. And you can sort of see, okay, there's a cyclicalness to this, and we can start to expect that. Or we can look to see what activities we could do to supplement and potentially change that. Or maybe it's a larger cycle. It's a 7-year cycle. But I think that, yeah, elaborate sort of in sort of how the AI can help. I know it, like, I've been looking a lot at machine learning, and now that's leading me into deep learning. And to sort of say a very simple understanding that I have of, like, what is machine learning is that if you are doing a conversion from Celsius to Fahrenheit, you just give the computer the data points and it figures out the calculation between how do you convert. Whereas in normal programming, you would give the computer the calculation to convert. And so the machine learning kind of figures it out. So yeah, can you elaborate more on sort of the use of AI and how that works in these forecasting models?
Yeah, so we use AI and mobile marketing in different areas. There's a lot of investment on design, on video design, on static design. There's also a line to copywriting, to content writing, with all this big push suddenly of different softwares for based on AI. But also there's the line of data modeling, data predictions, and it is important that every agency has a data and analytics department or team investing time in collecting data from the client's customers, gathering it, collecting it, driving it, analyzing it, and leaving it to us, to the marketers, to structure it, to interpret it, to understand it, and to create the corresponding reports for the clients. Because it is true that AI help a lot of companies to provide a lots of hundreds, thousands of data. Some of them are more useful than others, but the ability to interpret, to analyze and understand all this data, all these reports come from the human part, right? So we need to understand all this data. We need to understand what is useful, what is attached to our priorities, and what is, like, more secondary. Because what the client is always interested in is on the feedback, is on the insights you provide with all this data. They are not interested or fairly interested in how you collect this data, how are we collecting this data, how are we streaming it, with which APIs are we collecting this data, what tools are we using. Sometimes they ask, they do, but they are not really into it because they are paying you to do it. So they just want to know that the information is right, that the reports are right, and the feedback and the conclusions you are driving because of this data is the proper ones. Yeah, that's why I meant about attaching KPIs to our activities, to all of our activities in any business, from community management, no matter if we are working with tweets, with posts, but also with paid advertising. So we align all in the main business goals. Knowing which KPI should we target is also part of us, of humans, driving the right way or the proper way to canalize, channelize, so to say, is part of the AI, part of the data and analytics team, in case we have any. all these issues that you may find to attach all these KPIs, to collect all this data, is also part of our ongoing, I would say, challenges when working on a digital environment. I'm not sure if you have heard about this privacy sandbox that Google announced. Apple applied on the App Store like over a year ago, and it has been really a nightmare for every marketer, everyone. When I remember, it was like nearly 2 years maybe ago, the Apple started to track off the user identification. So the pixel that identify the user with a certain campaign from a certain ad in a certain ad network were just shut down. So you start getting data and you don't know where does these users come from. You don't know anymore where does this revenue come from. Now it's the time for Google to do the same thing. So we will have this nightmare also for Android products, probably by the end of this year, beginning of the next one. So at the end, you need to find always a get around. AI might be helpful in some cases, because now, for example, there are some companies developing what they call predictive modeling instead of using this user fingerprint. So I think this would be probably the future, although currently isn't, I would say, as proper implemented as they should. But I think with the time, same happens with electric cars, at some point everyone will have them. So at some point, we will all be using this predictive modeling and these media mix modeling conversions to track users, being privacy centric. I think we would lead to this path, and hopefully we will find the way easier with AI.
Yeah, no, I think AI is definitely the revolution that we're in right now, and it's significant. And I think that everybody needs to be paying attention to it and finding their way into understanding it. I even feel like the public has to have a role in being a guardrail when it's not working, and to know when to speak up and say that it is creating bias or unfairness or just not working right, because these are not perfect systems and we need to be able to report them and just see how they're utilized. Because I do think the goal of tech and the people I know in tech are very positive and very much inviting and creating the future, but they don't always have the thought process of what happens when threat actors start using these same technologies. They seem to want to create for good, and they have that mindset that whatever I'm doing is good. It's a positive thing in the world. And I think that we all sort of have to understand, no, it doesn't always work that way. And we all need to have a shared responsibility in making sure that these technologies aren't used in ways that they weren't necessarily ideally created for, but can still be utilized in ways that create harm.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it can be very tricky. I heard this afternoon, for example, over the news, that there were a case of some students that were faking their colleagues at school. So we are talking about secondary kids in the secondary stage, and they were like putting the colleagues' faces into like naked adult bodies, and they get sued for it, that because they are not adults yet. We have this issue and this great challenge with AI, because it can harm us a lot as well. So we have to see the two sides of every technology. Is always the same. There's always some people that tend to use it in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and I just think as a society, as a global community, we all need to be aware of that. It's that these things can happen. I mean, I think one example of this is Facebook has community guidelines and TikTok has community guidelines, but every country employs their own team to manage those community guidelines and sets their own algorithms to flag content. And so, for example, they can't have community managers in every country speaking every language. And there's many countries in the world who speak multiple languages. So when they had the coup in Myanmar, there was nobody managing that because they didn't have anybody hired at Facebook who spoke the language. And so things that an English speaker would never have been able to get away with because it was in a language that they had just not considered needing to monitor, you can have these basically violent takeovers happen when people sort of misappropriate a technology. And I use TikTok as an example because I was doing a lot of advocacy for Ukraine and I kept getting dinged by the American moderators. And yet I would see content that was coming from Russian moderators who did not moderate with the same standards. And so for every post that I made that I felt was totally in line with community guidelines and was not different than other things I was seeing come out of other countries, I was getting flagged for it. And I was getting very frustrated to the point that I actually left the platform because I said, this is just not a fair application.
Yeah, sometimes it even happens with the Spanish languages. So it's like English is always the focus language. We should all be communicating with this language. If you don't speak language, you are not even able, for example, to open an account on Google Ads or any other ad network because, of course, the landing page is in your language, but then you click on it and then start suddenly appearing everything in English. So it is impossible not to work without the English language because of this, because they don't have people in every single language working that can revise, can support you. So I understand the companies cannot have, like, I don't know how many languages are in the world, 300 or whatever many languages should be. But at some point, you need to get acquainted that there are some also tricks that because of this, people are doing. For example, there is even Black Hat SEO and ASO that with tricks we do in certain countries, especially what we call T3 countries, which can be, for example, India or Mexico, the Latin region, you can trick Google's algorithm, although it's hugely nowadays sophisticated, because they are not targeting these regions, and you can do some tricks to pay less, for example, via Google Ads, and get more users for the same price. So there are many tricks you can still doing. You can still trick Google in this sense because they are focused on T1 countries, especially English in the US, and they are not able to like extend their support as they do in the US to other regions. So, of course, we have different regulations in the European Union, across Europe, but there are many countries that they have all these fraud and technical issues, and especially like flexible laws that allows all these tricky behaviors to happen. And we need to start dealing also globally with these issues because all these issues are global, not country-wise. And we need to start understanding also that we are working on a global community and at some point we need some global regulations. I know it sounds a bit utopic, but at some point we need it, especially if we want to keep developing AI, for example.
I very much agree with that. I think the global regulations matter because within the US, and I imagine, you know, within each country, there's a set of rules and regulations. And if you create a contract within, if I create a contract with somebody within the United States, I can then take that contract to court and have it protected. If that person owes me money, if that person did something wrong, I have a set of laws that protect me. But as soon as you start doing international business, and we're not even talking about major companies and you were talking like just global governance issues, but to have that legal framework, because right now, if you do something with people outside of your own country and something goes wrong, there's no legal framework that really protects you. That's easy. And when you start to get into the international law space, it's expensive, it's clunky. It just seems worth letting it go and saying, okay, I just don't want to deal with that person anymore. I'll take that loss than to try to hold it accountable. And so I think that even if we want to have greater collaboration within countries, and then of course, when you start getting into these big, I'm kind of saying this from the idea of a very small company, but even these big companies that do operate globally have to be thinking about these things, like how much weight of the legal framework and the legal structure is there to support them. And I think that that makes global business challenging.
Yeah, even some companies like Google or Apple, Facebook, they are so big that they have to act as international concealers somehow, because there are no laws in the countries that allows them or forbids them to do certain things, because not every region or country has developed rules towards technologies, etc. And that's the reason sometimes, for example, Google or Facebook, we saw it also with Amazon, takes the lead on that and start regulating kind of globally by itself, because there are no rules at all in the market currently that they can attach to. So I think it's quite tricky. And sometimes we are leaving our rights in some sense to all these companies to deal with these issues, because there are no other regulations in the place. So at the end, we need to start dealing with a lot of issues on an ongoing basis, and then suddenly a scandal or a boycott comes up all over the news, and they start regulating as crazy without knowing too much about the topic itself. For example, the case of Amazon in Spain was quite big, because Amazon had some workers from Spain working in Germany, not legally, and they start being sued, and they start having to regulate all these technological affairs. But still, I think the whole European Union is struggling to make regulations, because like around 30 countries agree on something, it's kind of impossible nowadays. Technology moves forward much faster than us as human beings or us as a society, and there's a lot of challenges in this sense. There's a difference between also knowing and understanding. Understanding is a way to get acquaintance with something. You might know, for example, that AI might hurt somehow all this technology progress might hurt somehow some of our rights, of our private rights as people, as human. But you know it, but they don't really understand it, the full potential and all the options you have in your hand when applying this technology. I mean, it is like when you were a kid and your mother told you, don't go there, don't climb there, and you'll hurt yourself. And you go there, you know you can get hurt, but you still go there, start climbing it, and then you fall down and you hurt yourself. I mean, you are not silly. You can get yourself. You know you will get yourself, but until you don't get hurted, you don't understand it really. You need to like acquire this knowledge. That's how you can apply it also to all this AI potential. There's a lot of potential. There's a lot of ways to see these tools, but if until you don't get acquaintance of the importance of adapting our businesses, they only need to be regulated, and that's it. We need some guidelines. We need some experts digging into the topic and applying certain regulations like we've been doing all our lives. I mean, historically, it has always happened the same with technology. In the 50s was with the television. They would say they will leave out radio and radio businesses, but it didn't happen. Then it came internet, and internet they say they would shorten or make marginal the mass media, the televisions, but they didn't. It's still there. So what we need to do is kind of try to regulate all this new technology that it's sometimes, I would say, you can get scared, but it is regulation what we do need, and that's it. Same with internet. There's, I would say, hundreds of thousands of challenges we faced over all these years, and not that many years. I mean, the internet became broad like what, 10 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, a bit more. But I mean, it was a broad problem to deal with all these issues when the internet came. So same happens with AI, and I think we will deal at some point, probably later than sooner, but at some point we will deal with this regulations. We will have the same challenges, so I think it will come up with an agreement at some point. I would say the workflow for most businesses, not only developers, but us working in the digital environment, have always very similar phases. First, the product, you start polishing your product, you start wanting to market your product or your service in the market. You need like to deal how to market your product, your service, and then you want to start building this go-to-market strategy as well. So at the end, all of these phases should be data-driven and should be applied to, I would say, any digital business at least, and I would say any business in general, although it might imply like other processes, like even working in a supermarket, they cash every single dollar they made. So we need to have these data-driven mindsets. I saw that most companies fail doing this. For example, usually mobile developers, specifically speaking, they have like four different milestones or stages where they start working on this go-to-market strategy. We have first on this initial phase, this initial stage, they start with the need of getting more users. They want more users into their apps. They need to generate more leads for their business. They want to drive organic installs, organic traffic, by organic traffic, acquiring users without paid ads, without paid traffic. From, for example, their own media, like their own website, social content, video content, etc. So they start with this need. Then they move on to the second milestone, which would be for any mobile developer, they realized they should start investing on paid ads, paid advertising. They start investing in quality rather than quantity because they see they are getting some users, but those users aren't bringing enough value or they don't fit into the value proposition of the product. So they start doing some paid advertising. In this case, they might hire an agency or they might hire someone to drive these paid acquisition efforts. On the third stage or third step, they realize they should invest in other type of marketing activities like monetizing these users, start testing waterfalls, test pricing, keep on running paid advertising, optimize it, do retargeting, set up maybe a SEO, search engine optimization, or an app store optimization strategy. With SEO or app store optimization, what we mean is optimizing your website or your product page in the corresponding mobile store with keywords so that your product visibility is not relied on the algorithm, on Google's algorithm. This way, your product starts appearing in Google results, in Google search queries, without the need of thousands of users driving into your web or your application. So you have all this set up and running. You have SEO, ASO, you have paid ads, as mentioned, also monetization. So what's next? What's next? The business already allocates organic activities in an initial stage. Then on a second phase, they start doing paid advertising. Then on a third phase, they become more sophisticated. They might hire an agency to support them to optimize their strategy, their marketing strategy loops. They come up with monetization strategy, etc. So the last and final step is to iterate, to keep optimizing this strategy, this ongoing strategy. Once everything is set up and running, we need to refine all these ongoing activities, ongoing action. And this is when data and analytics become crucial. And here is where most companies, as already mentioned, fail at. They fail to establish KPI-based activities. They fail to keep growing because they are not able to plan to make a proper or realistic forecast. So the need of establishing all these KPIs, setting up goals, OKRs to forecast results is so essential that will decide whether a business will succeed or fail. We've been all through this conversation, but you need to start looking into your forecast. You need to start looking forward. You need to attach all your marketing activities and your product activities to your business goals to understand your business potential. And it is not an easy task. So I totally understand if companies don't get it properly set up the first time or the first 2-3 times, because it is really a great task. You also need to have a proper analytics plan. You need to be able to track users, revenue, and that's a whole lot of time, effort, and nightmares you will have, because it's of course allocating growth to your marketing and aligning with these business goals will also help to identify your plan, if your plan is working well, if not, if you need to make some changes. So all this comes with a timeline. At the end, the client needs not only a clear communication, they need a proper, clear plan. They need this plan to be attached to certain KPIs. And they need to understand that if they want to lower the budget, if they want to cut some activities, the performance will decrease accordingly. So that's where we come up with the first question of the interview, that where is the balance of all this? You need to be very data-driven at the end. So that's the real key point in this business.
You talked about proactive listening, and I really loved that. Can you just expand on proactive listening and how that ties into what you were just talking about, being data-driven and KPIs and just that relationship management?
So proactive listening is the way to listen based on understanding what's the feedback about and taking actions. So we don't have to leave out this second part, because some companies tell you everything, that it's okay, we can go, we can do this. And after, when the client signed the contract, they just forget about it. You need to take actions based on this feedback. You need to get acquaintance, that otherwise the relationship might be harmed, not only with the clients, but also with the workers within a company. If a colleague, if a coworker tells you something, you really need to evaluate together and to assess whether the feedback provided makes sense to apply it, to integrate it in the business, in the process. Because otherwise, it's just listen. I mean, everyone can listen, everyone can act, but it is like a process. You don't have, it is very unusual to have things get right on the first place. So it's like try and error. You try one thing, you try one hypothesis, you might fail, or it is okay, but you need to keep improving it. So that's like the whole loop of optimizing everything in your business to keep improving your figures and to keep making clients happy. I would say they need to understand what are the needs of the developer. It doesn't matter if it's a software, a B2B, a B2C company. If we are talking about mobile applications, they need to understand what's the product about. That's really important. And that's not a small advice, I would say, because I have this feeling that many companies handle products or handle clients without knowing well the product. And I mean, I can talk about so many examples of irritating conversations with clients and companies and misleading communication. You need to know very well your product. Why? Because you need to understand the audiences you are targeting. You need to understand the niches. So niches are the riches, right? In we say that this in marketing. We need to target properly each of our actions so that we have like a very optimized flow and a very well optimized plan when scaling up our business. We need to know where to point, what to point, how to do it, what are the problems that we are solving. So the best thing is to start knowing your product. For example, when I introduced myself here, I didn't say if I was mother of three kids or not. And I don't like to say that. I don't like to speak if I'm mother or not, because it's like a common sentence we add at the end. I'm a, I don't know, software engineer. I live in this company. But and after they say, I'm mother of three kids, no? But no man said I'm a father of two sons or I'm a father. It's unusual to hear that. So I would say that this burden of carrying our private life to professional life is something that is specific for women. It doesn't matter if you have kids or not. It doesn't matter if you have to take care of your parents, for example. But at the end, what you really need is to understand if you are a good professional or not. And we need to try to balance it out a bit so we can be compared as professional with men and not only as mothers or as daughters of someone.